Okay.
It won't be fast.
Chaim. Now we're on air, okay? I don't know. Does Asher know? Yoni? I don't know. Okay. Welcome to my parents, our guests for sure today. Okay. So, the last few months, we dealt with issues in Psak, sort of direct issues in Psak from the vantage point of the laity, right? How do you pick your posek? What authority do you have when you pick your posek? When can you pafkin for yourself? Under what circumstances? What does it take to be qualified? When are you too biased? We dealt with chumros, which already moved to a new dimension. The question of when can you initiate new religious practice. The next two shiurim are going to deal with a different element of this picture, which is the question: to what extent does practice on the ground, what people actually do, affect how psak is formulated? And we're going to deal with that in the next 2 weeks in two different ways. Marty. One, this week, we're going to deal with a test case of how the way people act affects the formulation of psak, or the actual institution of halachot. And you'll see what I mean in a minute. And next week, we're going to deal with the extent to which practice affects how we not create new halachot, but how we figure out what the halacha probably is, right? As a factor when we're trying to discern what psak is actually correct, right? So next week, what we'll deal with is the role of minhag b'shetach, you know, practically what people are doing, how that affects how poskim decide how to rule, which we talked about a little bit last year. We'll flesh it out a little bit next week. This week, this is going to be a flip shear of a shear we gave last year. So the case I want to take specifically is the case of the slippery slope. Right? Last year we spoke about the role of the slippery slope in psak. Someone want to quickly summarize what the slippery slope is, who was here last year or not?
It's complicated.
Thank you. what is a slippery slope argument?
It is we can't do this thing even though we would want to do it because it would lead to unintended consequences.
Right. So we point out
bad unintended consequences.
Right. So a classic slippery slope argument is we can't do X, right? Not because X is intrinsically bad, but because X will likely lead to Y, and Y is intrinsically bad. Right. That's a classic slippery slope argument. There are modified slippery slope arguments where, because X will lead to Y, that indicates that X itself is bad. Yeah. And we noted halachically, right, there's a lot of precedent for making slippery slope arguments. We call that classically what? What do we call a halachic class? What? A gedder, or a gzera, right, a fence, right? Any rabbinic law is probably, many rabbinic laws, not all, but most, are under this category, right? Are essentially formalized legal slippery slope arguments, right? Because we don't want you to violate that which is intrinsically bad. Read Daraisa, right? Biblical law. Therefore, we set up a rabbinic law to protect you, right? That's what we spoke about last year, right? And we spoke about under what parameters. Do you have to be open about what you're doing? This is essentially a policy concern. Or are you allowed to obfuscate it, right? Make people think that it's d'oraisa in order to really protect it. We showed how that was a machlokes both halachically, the Rambam and the, anyone remember? It's a long time already. The Maharil. And then we, you know, did some historical examples. We showed how this was one of the main machlokot during the rise of the reform in the 19th century, right, between, if you remember at all, during the Psak Din of Michalowska. Let's see, you do remember. You have your notes at the Psak Din of Michalowska, or how you pronounce that word, between
Rosh
Hashanah Hirsch. Hillel Chumsin, thank you, and? Very good, Maram Shek. Look at that, good notes. And then we carried it to modern. Thank you. Good. So that's what we dealt with last year. And then we followed it through to some modern cases, and we tested a little bit with the partnership minyan and tefillin, I think. Did we do that? I think we did, right? Yeah. Probably.
That was Friday.
What?
That was the Friday at the end.
Yeah. No, that we definitely done this year. That did not publicize. Yes. Okay. So that was last year. Now, that Shiurim, of all the Shiurim I gave last year, had the most feedback from the people listening through Wayutera, right? And the people who were reading my summary, right? And I ended up writing two follow-up posts to that. Much of it in response to a comment by David Walkenfeld, he's the rabbi in ASBI, Anshei Shalom B'nai Israel. You know, you're Chicago. Right, that's Rabbi Lopatin Shul, old Shul, Anshei Shalom B'nai Israel. So he took over there, and he noted to me that there was this article by Rav Shurlo that I should read that touched on these issues. Now it does, but what it really does is it touches on the opposite question, which is the question that we're dealing with this year. Right, last year we talked about, right, under what circumstances would one want to institute a gzeira because of a slippery slope argument. How would you present it, and the like. Right, those are the questions from the vantage point of Poskim, right? But what we didn't really talk about enough is, well, how does the effect of what people do, or might react to this Zera, how does that affect the actual institution of these slippery slope type arguments? Okay, so that's what I want to do. So what I want to do is I want to analyze this article. I gave you the whole thing. We're not going to read, obviously, the whole thing. But, you know, as long as I'm giving to you, I might as well give you the full thing so that if you want to read it, you can. But basically, he was asked to weigh in on a moral question that was an ethical question. And he wanted to know whether halacha had something to say as to the meta issues. Okay, so the specific issue, and you can look at the beginning. We won't go through all the details, but just to look at what he was talking about. One of the thorny ethical issues that doctors deal with. What's the issue? It's all modern Hebrew. You should get it. Im nachon lavsher lezug levchoret min haubar shalahem.
Gender selection.
What?
Gender selection.
Gender selection. Right? Should we allow child? Yes. Should we allow parents who are having children through IVF, IUF, to choose the gender of their child? Rabbi Noseize Yatza b'mei 2005 Choser. Shelman Kal, Misrad Habriyud, Ubo Nichtav, Ki Kechlal, Breirat, Min Hayilud, Lamatara, Sheena Matara, Refuit, Asura, Ach Itachain, Teese, Ach Virak, Bimikrim, Yotse Dovin, Harigim, Nidirim, Umiuchadim. The official statement from the medical office of the government was that, as a general rule, unless there's a medical reason, they will not allow, or they would not encourage at least, or they would forbid, really, allowing parents to choose the gender, except with very exceptional cases. B'ma'amaro ben ubat, b'chan Professor Noam Zohar et sheilat hatkafot ha-pilosofit v'mishpatit shel chozer mankal zeh b'nogel avchana trom ha-shartit o b'sef ha-meduberet b'chirat min ha-yulud b'afraya Mevrayat Mivchana. And then Noam Zohar dealt with the philosophical implications in the case of IVF. Professor Zohar Bachan Hora'ot Elu Mishloshai Beitim. So he looked at this question from three perspectives. Habeit HaRishon Hu Ir'ur Al HaAnacha HaMofi'a B'Chozer HaManchal Ki HaEmda HaLiberalit HaMakira B'Zchut Bilti Me'oreret Shel HaIsha K'Chilek MeHa'Antonimia Shelo Mechavet leheter shimush chovshi b'chol technologia kayemet uftucha. The first perspective that he dealt with was the challenge that perhaps the liberal notion that women have full autonomy over their reproduction, that the people who thought that is true challenged this limitation. The second one was some of the practical considerations. And he went through it. So now what he skipped to the next paragraph. Right? So whatever arguments they brought, look at the second paragraph. And these were Baram, however, right? Whatever their claims were, Tiyun echad chashuv bolet behedero hein michozer amankal vehein bitkuvato shel Professor Zohar. There was one missing element to the argument. Lo yehiyeh ze mugzam lit'on ki kim'at b'chol makom ba'olam shebo nidona hasugya etit shel breirat min ha'ubar mofia nimuk ha'pilosofi v'hamusari shel sakanat ha'midron ha'chalaklak. If people remember what this is, what in almost all ethical conversations about choosing gender, they raised which concern? What's the midrona chalaklak?
Slippery slope.
Right? Tiyuna midrona chalaklak koveya ki eina lehatir davar. And let's see how much this fits with our formulation last year. The slippery slope argument establishes ki ein lahatir davar, or you can't permit anything. Masha ulai ra'ui kshehu la'atzmo, even if it's something that might intrinsically be proper. On the concern that allowing it would lead after this to, what's hidar derut?
Something bad.
Intermarriage. Mixed dancing.
Thank you. What is hidar derut? What does the word hidar derut mean?
What I said, what you said.
Degeneration. Right? Lihit dar der, to get worse. Right? Things will get worse. And lead to mixed dancing. Yes, okay. I know. That's the punchline of every joke. I get it. Okay. Klomar. Have you ever actually read Rav Henkin's Tshuva on mixed dancing?
Should I?
If you... Well, he's responding to an entire kuntrus that came out of mixed dancing, right? Which basically does exactly what you said, right? Which is the everything is usher because it comes to... Yeah, anyways. Klomar, hetirim nosovim nosim chamarim yoter. Kaamur... But it's totally left out of these two articles. So I don't want to deal with the question itself. Can you choose the gender? Ela lahadgim. Okay. On the second page. Second side of the first page. El hadgin b'emtzauta et hamurkavut shel hashimush b'tiyun hamedrona chalaklak. So this is really what I want to deal with. He's going to use this case to as a paradigm of how to deal with the complexity of the slippery slope argument. V'zot kim matza l'diyun ha'ikari shehu trumat halacha l'kronot ha'ela v'atmurat ha'noldat mi'ad dialog bein shtei asafot ha'chatit v'ha'etid ha'klalit. And this is what he thinks is the main contribution that halacha can make to the conversation between halacha and general ethics. Matarat ha'ma'amar y'kfula, so the goal of the article is double. Ha'matarai rishona yilvchon im b'chayenu adatiyim anu osim shimush yeter b'ti'un ha'midrona chalaklak. First thing he wants to know is if in our religious lives we use the argument of the slippery slope too much. Li'itim, at some point it seems, domesh anu sovrim ki aderech adatit mechayevet lachshosh b'chol eit mipnei adar derut. Sometimes it seems like being religious means always being worried by the possibility of degeneration. So we create many prohibitions. But I will claim, right, paying more attention not to what pushes us in the direction of forbidding things based on the slippery slope argument, but rather focusing on the pitfalls of using that argument will lead us to a better psak. Hamatara shniya, the second goal of the article, afucha bechivuna, in the opposite direction, is anaseh lahatik et halacha mitchum asiyach hapnimi shela el siyach haeti haklali, uladgim et hatshuma hatsuma shelacha yichol lahanik lediyun haeti haklali. Then I want to try to generalize from the specific halachic conversation to the general ethical one. Kamur b'makom ladun b'model tiareti b'charti lihadgim et dvarai b'amtsu tzugya ma'asid omed al seder ayom shel ha'etika ha'refuit. But instead of doing this as a theoretical exercise, I decided to take on this practical case. Okay? So far we're good? Good. Okay. So now what he's going to do, and this will lead us to, you know, really to our issue, is what factors would lead us to not want to forbid things because of the slippery slope. Right? So, first section. Malatiyun amerkazi neged breirat mina ubar. So, kamur b'ma'amara nal chuzer man kalmina meket shoshay ha'it nagduk l'shimush racha b'technologi azu b'chamishani mukeh. Right, so we're not going to read most of this section, but let's just see the main arguments. These are the five arguments made against allowing parents to choose the gender of their child. What are they? One, tiyunim refuim musariim keneged bitzua peula refuit anoseit b'chova sikun l'matara sheina refuit. So the first one is, it's not necessary medically, and it is, like any other surgery,
dangerous.
Right. Two. Mamadam shall bring me a min shall nuchar lahashrasha. The second question you have to ask is the Mamadam shall ubarim mehamin.
Oh, what is
the status of a fetus, right? Or of an embryo or an egg or right, whatever stage this is at. Three is miniyat magamat fliya benamin mechavra, the potential problem of right discrimination amongst genders. Four is shmirat ha'izun ha-demografi, and right, that's sort of a moral problem, but then there's also the demographic problem. And five is k'mochein ein le'etalei me'alod ha-kaspid ha-gvalaj ha-tzua PGD ha-machayev gam bitzua fraya chutz gufid. And then there's also the price. Okay, that was his arguments, okay? We're not so interested in his arguments. We want the specific slippery slope one, okay? So, section B. Right, skip to the next side of the page. Tkufa... Kufato shel tiyun ha-madron ha-chalaklak. Tiyun ha-madron ha-chalaklak, hu tiyun yisodi kim'at b'chol diyun eti. The slippery slope argument is fundamental to basically every ethical argument. Madua ifa wa hishmit oto, Professor Zohar. So why is it left out? Ha-yisod ha-ikari shel tana zo. Hishein lav livchon et maaseh ha-konkreti lor ha-yisodot ha-etiyem ha-tmunot bo bilvad ela yesh livchon gam et ha-shlachot. What it says that ethically you can't just limit your perspective to the issue at hand. You have to look at everything that could stem from it. In addition, even if you're dealing with things that are not inevitable, when in theory one could stop the problem before it degenerated to that point, hasikun shalona says zot or shalonizeh b'kach matzid gagbala b'asiya. If practically you're not going to stop it, then you're allowed to use the slippery slope argument. Tkufat hashimush b'tiun ha-midron ha-chalaklak hutkefa mi-chivunim shonim ve'ila shloshet ha-tiunim ha-kerim neget tkufata. Okay, so now what he's going to do is he's going to set up three theoretical limitations on using the slippery slope argument. And then he's going to try to prove that they exist within halacha. But before he tells you how they exist in halacha, I want you to think about it, okay? Yeah? Mm-hmm. Okay, so number one. Tiyunam midrona chilaklak banuya anachar kishlonam atzaifui shel acherim o shel achevra. Right, the first critique of the slippery slope argument is that who usually are you forbidding? Right? Why are you forbidding Reuven from doing something? Because you're worried that who's going to do something?
Why?
Someone else. Right? So the first ethical critique of it is that you're essentially hurting somebody, right? Because you're limiting their rights that they should in theory have because what they're doing is itself not ethically problematic because of what other people might do with it. Right? You're holding back rights that someone has a right to because of others. Right here, you're worried that you know everyone will start using it and now cause the demographic problems, the health problems, etc., etc. You're not saying these parents don't have the right to choose the gender of their child. You're saying that if they do, that would lead to something else, but you're holding back their rights. And that is at least an ethical problem that has to be dealt with. Klal lo barur mimchina eti chayav yachid l'shalem and mechir rishlonu tavik kishlonu tashel achav ralik modeid imasakanot haglumot b'talich. Zeh. It's not clear that ethically an individual has to pay the price for the potential failure of others. Right, so now if we want to go back last year, right, to when we gave the slippery slope shear last time, right, if you remember, this was one of the big problems with the slippery slope argument in halacha, right, is for some people, what?
It's not a problem.
It's not a problem. More than it's not a problem, it's maybe it's good for them, right? Maybe there's a reason they're doing it. But if you forbid it because it's slippery slope, right, there's a cost, because certain people for whom the gzera is not right, they will still be hurt. And now he sharpens it. He said, it's not just that you're hurting Reuven for Shimon, it's you're definitely hurting person A on the possibility that someone else might violate. Right? So it's the real ethical issue is, can I limit you from doing something, right? Can I for sure take away your rights to protect society from a potential danger? Right? So Maleva Hamirubani Tendalus Kana Sharishal Garubi Major Atidi Mitashteshid Aidha Uvdaj and Gormin before Bove Avil Vadai Bimo Yadeno Michivunsha Mechivansha Anu Nimnaim Lazo Davar Nachon Ata. And the fact, and they're right, he said this gets clouded often, that we're actually doing something wrong, right? There is a cost to what we do when we forbid something in the here and now. The classic case is where we don't let somebody stop life support, even if it might technically be permitted, because we're worried that someone might euthanize him, right? But that in practice, right, when you don't allow cutting off life support, there are people who are in pain, right? Assuming it's mutter under the circumstances, right? Those are all the qualifiers he puts in. Fine. And this is what we talked about a little bit last year, right? In halacha, this is often used in women's issues in the shul. The gam. Right, and you have to wonder, right, is it worth the cost to forbid things that are permitted because of some future concern? So that's critique one, is that you're hurting people in the here and now, you're taking away their rights because of a potential danger. Two, Hamajornal Khalaklak Banuel Khanaut she putit rabot mehen imperiot biltina lamedida. Right? All slippery slope arguments need what? Right, what are they built on?
A potential danger.
Right? Which is what type of danger? Right? Whether or not that danger is going to exist, right? What type of question is that?
Societal, question.
Imperiot.
Empirical.
Right, it's an empirical question which can't be predicted. Right, Barry Lynn cannot actually tell us whether it's going to snow on Friday. Yes, it is on recording. Right,
he can tell us.
He can tell us, but meteorology is right. It is an empirical question which cannot actually conclusively be measured in advance. We can hope and predict, right, and we can be wrong.
Just hope that meteorologists are listening to this.
Let's hope Barry Lynn is listening. Stop telling us that there is going to be snow when there isn't. Thank you. Okay. B'derech klal, b'shashim akshin... What?
Divorce your wife.
What?
That too. He puts it on his public website. If I make one more mistake, my wife's going to divorce me. How many times has he written that this winter alone? Okay. Anyways. B'derech klal, b'shashim akshin, l'shem eish b'tiyun amedera nachal klag, yesh laniach shalosh hanachot. And now this is the really important one, okay? This is where I really want you to pay attention, okay? So, when we try to figure out empirically how dangerous, right, how important is it to set up a gzera, right? Let's start using halachic language again so things become clear. To set up a gzera, right, a new law, when we want to initiate a new law, a slippery slope argument, what we call an halach a gzera, a geder, a takana, whatever, right? There's an empirical question at hand. How dangerous is it How potentially dangerous is it that some Isser is going to be violated? So he said, the empirical question we have to gauge based on several factors. Hanacha Rishona, Oseget V'Sheilat HaSikui. Right, here you're going to practice a lot of your modern Hebrew here. First question is predicated on Sikui. What's Sikui?
Likelihood.
Likelihood. Chance. Or in English, right?
Probability.
Right? Hasikun. Kidei lektakev et hashimush b'dun hamidron ha-chalaklak. Anuzrichin laniach she'achein yish sikui gadol dayo she'achlaka b'midron achein titrachesh. My first question you ask is, probabilistically, how likely is this result going to be? K'chol she'olah sikui ke'achlaka titrachesh kein mutzdeket yoter shlilat ha-zchuyot ha-ba'alim noah. The more probable the degeneration, the more rights you have to limit people's rights, i.e., the more dangerous, the more likely people will violate Isurim, the more Isurim you can create. Yes? Biram, however, medidara sikui hi bayatit me'od. But measuring probability is very difficult. Right? You have biases going into it. Namely, right? Because when you're asking the probabilistic question, there are two questions you're asking. One is
how
likely is this result? And the other one is
how widespread or how bad it would be.
How bad it would be, right? One is the right value question, one is the factual question, right? One is how bad it will be, and the second question is how bad does it have to be worth setting up a gzeira, right? The empirical question comes with the value judgment, right? That's one. Right, etc. Fine. Second one is hanachada shniya oseget b'sheilat hasikun. Right, first one is the probability. The second one is?
How bad would it be?
How bad would it be? Meaning, right, if there's a 75% chance that if we don't do this, that people will have too much ice cream, right? In a chanami, too much ice cream, maybe it's a violation of v'nishmartem. What?
No such thing.
See, this is the problem, right? You know? So, a potential violation of v'nishmartem, you're supposed to be healthy, but is that dangerous enough, right? You know, people violate v'nishmartem, they eat too much, what it happens, right? That's not, even if it's a 95% chance that the result of, you know, allowing pick famous ice cream in America that is not yet kosher, that will become kosher, I don't care. Or candy or something, I don't know. Pick.
Carville.
It's kosher.
It's called
kosher. All right. What? I don't know, pick some.
All ice cream in America is basically kosher.
Pick something else. Chocolate, candy, I don't care. Pick something.
Bacon.
Skittles in America. Fine. Right? Skittles in America, right? If we gave a hechsher to Skittles, right? We brought the recipe they have in Israel to America and we gave them a hechsher.
Are they really that good?
I don't know. And they're candy, whatever. Right? Is it worth making a gzera on the chash that everyone will eat too much Skittles and will gain a pound this year? Right? Is it worth that? Right? Is that considered so dangerous? I understand, okay, it's not healthy, right? But is that so bad? Right? So the second question, first question is sikui, right? The probability. The second one is the sikun, right? What are we worried about? How bad is it? Right? Hebrew, by the way, that's beautiful here, right? And chayvin lekva ki atahom shenidader eileh amukadaya kidei livnok deirod hamonod erachlaka b'mechir asiyat avel. Right? That sentence is just beautiful, right? Even if we establish with certainty that this generation will happen, we are obligated to establish that the what's a good English for Tom? The
depth.
What?
Abyss.
The abyss, thank you. Oh. The abyss to which we would degenerate is deep enough that we have to build fences that prevent the slipping at the price of doing an injustice. It's a very... What? It worked much better in Hebrew. In English, it's very complicated. Okay. Then he brings his example. Fine. The third is, right, this is over. We have sikui, sikun, right? Probability. It's four pages. One, two, three, four. There you go. Choose an article. Right? First one is sikui. Second one is sikun, right? First is the probability that the danger is going to happen. The second one is the danger that it would happen. How bad would it be if it did happen? And the third is?
The cost.
The mechir. What is the price? Right? How bad would it be? Right? If I mean, how? What is the cost if we actually do some of the gzera? Right? Asharat matzav anatun. What? No, meaning, what are we losing? Right? Meaning, we said that whenever we set up a gzera, you lose some rights. But how many rights are we giving up? Right? What is the cost? Right? You have to ask, what is the cost? Right? It's related to the... They're obviously all related, right? How dangerous it is and how worth it is, how is, right? You have to balance these three factors. Right? Kamur, b'shem tina amidrona chalak lakam, b'shem levnot z'chuda kayem be'obet. Right? We've already said, you have to withhold rights in the present. V'dubar m'nizion l'shakleil... Right, what you need to do, any gzera basically needs to balance three factors. Right, these three factors. Right, is it worth setting up the gzera considering how likely it'll happen, how bad it would be if it did happen? Right, balanced against
the price,
the cost. Right, the not really price, the cost. Right, the English would be cost. No.
Yes.
Right. The cost. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Fine. Now, then he makes the one more argument, which you have to take into account, and this is what people say all the time. What is the biggest danger of the slippery slope argument?
People will disrespect the entire system.
Yes. How? Because of the the famous slippery slope of the slippery slope, right? Right? That's three. Right? Yeshna stira logit pinimit b'shimosh b'din abidron al chalaklag. That's Gimel, right? Ta'anat abidron al chalaklag b'nuyach shash hider l'taomot gumim mishal shimosh yoter b'eter misuyam. Ta'anat azot efshar lachil gam al tiyun abidron al chalaklag atzma, right? The slippery slope of slippery slopes. At some point, you're so cautious that what?
And nothing's allowed.
Right, nothing's allowed, right? Everything, right? Once you start using these, right, you start forbidding things which are actually permitted, right? You start forbidding everything's permitted because of a chash, of a chash, of a chash, of a chash that'll lead to mixed dancing. Right? Right? Etc. And this is a particular problem. As we've said, right, considering the fact that we admit that there is a cost, right, that is why that is why we have to be worried about using it, okay? So that's the issues on the table. Now, halachically, now let's move to halachic arguments. So, are there halachic principles that would weigh in on these three issues? Amen. Sikuin, sikun, mechir. Yes or no?
Yes.
Good, what are they?
Ain goes in gzera al gzera.
Like, good. Ain goes in gzera al gzera. Right? What does that mean?
The slippery slope is not a slippery slope. You can't do it.
Right. You can't make a slippery slope on a slippery slope argument because you're not allowed to make a rabbinic commandment to protect a rabbinic commandment because only biblical commandments have the right to be protected. Right? If you, because what happens when you protect a protection?
Slippery slope.
It needs protected. The
slippery slope. You?
It needs
Well, first of all, it means protect again, but more importantly, what do? You blur the line between...
Daraita and
Darabana. Yeah, Daraita and the Ikar and the main, right, the central problem and the peripheral, right? Good. Some more, and then we'll see which one he uses. He does use that one, right? Another one.
Loplug. That's already the opposite.
And Loplug, yeah, it's the opposite, right?
But there are times when we don't say Loplug.
That's for sure true. So, let's look at his five, okay? We won't read all of them inside, but I want to talk about them more outside, okay? You can look at them inside, but I think he's, right? What he does here, I think, is just, it's a really beautiful job. So, the first one is, and this is, I think, the most important, right? This is the one that really gets to the heart of the question of what is the role of the hamonam, the populace, the laity, in the halakhic process, right? This is the question we're really asking is, when Chazal, when someone's about to make a new gzera, a new rabbinic law, right? And they look at the people and they say, should we or should we not impose a law on them? Right? What halachic rule tells us that there's a limitation on slippery slope arguments, on gzeros? Good, look at number one. Ein goes in gzera latzibur ela in kain rov atzir mer yicholim lamod ba. You can't make a gzera. You can't decree something unless... What? Unless the majority of people can stand up to the gzera. If most people can't handle it, then...
You can't do it.
You can't do it, yes.
Who makes that consideration?
Ah, so who makes that consideration? Well, presumably...
The rabbi.
The rabbi, right? Always, right? He has a responsibility to take into account, but he's the one making it. But... there's an important machlokas which he doesn't discuss between the Rambam and the Bali Atosos. I remember Shriver showed this me many years ago. Right, the Rambam in Hillel's Mamre, in Hillel's Sanhedrin, I think, and Tosos in Abu Dazar, the Talmud development. Aleph, Ein goes in Gzera let Sibor. So let's say you did set up a Gzera, right? Obviously, you can't set up a Gzera that you know in advance people won't be able to handle. That's obvious. What happens if you set up a Gzera and de facto people cannot handle it? What? Thank you, Machlokes.
Aren't there examples in the Gemara where these things happen? And
for sure. What happens? What happens that moment, right, when you set up a gzera and it turns out that people couldn't handle it? Just bashatah, and right, you go out, people couldn't handle it. You didn't realize they couldn't, right? Everyone agrees. You have to take into account. If people won't be able to handle the gzera, you don't set it up, doesn't matter the cause, right? Doesn't matter the danger. Because it's just not worthwhile. People can't handle it. But what happens if you didn't realize? Right? So what happens when you turn around and you say, people just failed? Right? We thought this was a good idea, and it wasn't because people couldn't handle it.
How could we ever know that?
You look around.
And what if...
They're violating it. Right? Rove.
Does that mean they can't handle it, or...
If Rove Sibor... Yeah. Now, it's a different question.
They want to violate it.
No. Rove Sibor... No, then they can. Then they can be Omid Bo. Right?
But we don't know that, because everyone's violating it.
No, so I'm saying, once they're violating it, that we consider Einam Yicholim. Right? Meaning if everyone is practically violating it, there's a technical problem. What happens if generations can, and then at some point later on in history, right, people violate it? Right, that's a different story. But let's start with the easier question, is what happens immediately? Right, as soon as the gzera goes out, people just don't listen to it. So what happens to the gzera?
Do you need it for it to be officially moved, or is it canceled mail up?
Good, thank you. Right, so who holds what? So the Rambam says it is null and void automatically. Right? What people do and can handle is definitional to the halachic system. A derabbanan, a rabbinic law, does not exist if people did not keep it from that first moment. If that first moment, as soon as the rabbi set it up to protect the laws, and it turns out people couldn't handle it, the law disappears as if it never existed. Doesn't matter, all the rabbis in the world can kick and scream, right? Ein, right? It's obviously only true of rabbinic law, right? Exera. But, he reads this rule. His aim goes from zero to zibor, not just that you aren't allowed to decree it, but it doesn't work. It doesn't count as a decree, right? It just evaporates. Tosros says, no. Reuven, what do you need to do?
You need to
formally retract it, but it didn't have no effect. Normally, when you set up a gzera, what do you need to undo the gzera? A greater bezdin. What type of bezdin do you need to uproot a law in this case? Any bezdin. All you need is a formal erasure from the books, but it can be anybody. Any bezdin, even one that shouldn't be able to uproot it, right, is allowed to uproot it. Okay?
71.
What?
A bezdin.
What? Not of three. It's of whatever bezdin set it up. But it doesn't have to go to the Chachamim, presumably. Maybe 71, maybe 23, maybe whoever set it up, right? Tosos is not entirely clear on that, but it depends on who set it up, right? Which is the Sanhedrin, sure. But it doesn't have to be Memenu Bechachma Uviminyan, right? It doesn't have to be a greater Bezdin. So Rambam thinks that this rule tells us clearly, right, that one of the things that halacha has to say about slippery slope is en gozum gzeilah to elam kein rova tzir yachon lama. But now with all the background of Rishula, what it's really saying is what? Is that if what?
If the cost is too great.
If the cost is too high, such that practically people can't handle it, right? Then it's not a legitimate law, right? Then we can dispute, does it mean that it automatically evaporates or it evaporates or it just becomes easier to retract it, right? That's Machlokes Rambam Tosfos. But fundamentally, this principle tells us that what people do, right, in practice, right, affects how we institute protective laws and actually defines what is a legitimate protective law and what isn't, right? So that's one. And if you just look at the last paragraph of section Aleph, is im nechona derech machshava zu. If basically what I explain now is correct, hapilosofia shel achat toremet lidyuna klali b'davar amidyuna klal klat eda tiyun ki efshar sh'af sakanat hidardirut lo nagbil et ashur hashono b'shal uvda ki lo nitan lidvo mibchinat tziburit me'at tzibur la'amod b'magvalot kol chavurot. If the explanation we just gave is correct, what we've added to the philosophical discussion is that even if there is a real danger of degeneration, we will not limit rights if the limitation of rights itself is too painful, right? Proven by the fact that people can't handle it. So that's one. Two is what Chaim said, which is, Chaim, repeat. You just tell me, you don't have to read it, tell me. Angle and Zegzera is that we don't set up protective measures on protective measures, where we only allowed, right? We're not allowed to limit people's rights to protect our own protective measures. We can only limit your rights to protect things which are themselves intrinsically valuable. Or in halacha, we would call it
daraisa.
Is there an exception to that rule, though?
Maybe.
There are two exceptions to engos and zelagzera. One is, repeat it, Yair. Chazagzera is sometimes, right, multiple levels of protective laws are so closely linked that we consider it formally as one set of laws, right? One law, and therefore it's allowed. More important for our discussion, what is the second exception? Dabar chamur, right? Something which is chamur enough, something which is stringent enough, right? Where we will be gozer gzeira l'gzeira, right? The most famous example being, what's the most worst sin in the Torah? Not mixed that day. What? Worst. Avodazara, right? Avodazara, right? And if you learn the Gemara Avodazara, right? Do we make zeros like zeros?
Yes.
Gazru al yenan mishum shmanan mashmona mishum biden vavidim mishum binosev vavidosev mishum davaracher, right? Where it goes there on wine because of bread and bread, right? Right, the wine maybe not just because the oil, and the oil because of bread, and bread because of intermarriage, and intermarriage because of Avodazara. Right? It's Xera. Right, in the Ramban notes in Avodazara, and the Chassam Sofer says at the beginning of Hilchos Ein Nesef that when something is bad enough, we are gozer Xera Lexera. Which in Rav Shurlo's language, this falls into which of the three factors that we have to think about when we set up zeros?
Sikun,
right? Danger goes up, we limit your rights more, right? We're willing to make life harder if the danger is higher. Number three, Ain grows in Zera and? Yeah, Ruben.
What about Tekanota or not, which are not Zera, which are not very much for other reasons?
But, like?
In general, like societal concerns. Whatever
Rambam
would qualify as
takanot. Same thing, I think, right? I don't even know what a zero would be there, but yeah, I mean, I assume it's the same thing, no?
It's not a zero to protect this, like, whatever other concern.
It's not
a double level.
That's the kula chadak zero. When do you say kula chadak zero? What do we consider the fundamental value? I think it's subject to the same cheshbon. We'd have to, like... I mean, sometimes we definitely do, right? We make up, we make zera mishum darkei shalom, mishum... Right, meaning I think there are, but...
Can you make zera on a zera mishum darkei shalom?
We'd have to look. I offhand, I can't think of one. Okay, example number three, right? Where else do we not make zeros? Gimel?
Yeah.
Or just read the top for me. What does that mean?
If it's not likely.
If something is not likely, right, then we don't make a gzera for it. Which means, right, which of the three factors? Sikun, sikui, mechir. Sikui, right? How likely is it? And that's a gemara mefureshet, right? If something is unlikely to happen, even if when it does happen it's really, really bad, we don't set up a gzera. Right? So again, in his language, that means it's not worth limiting people's rights with excessive gzera if... if the likelihood of the degeneration is not so much. Okay? Four. Right? So I want to read the title of Dalet for... what does that mean?
If there's other ways to deal with the problem without having zeros.
Good. If there's another way to deal with the problem, then we don't do it, right? Right? One should have, ideally, put the responsibility to prevent the degeneration not on the shoulders of the person who had the right, but on who? The person who we're worried is going to
mess up.
Is going to mess up. Hatomchim b'shimos b'garna midrana chalaklak chokim al bikoret zu. Rami d'vei chazal olakim achinu kam aginyon b'li mamash v'otim chashav ishikul midrana chalaklak. Right, but from Chazal it's clear that, right, if we can, we will avoid setting up zero. For, look at footnote 30 here. Dugmaot, right? For example, right? Even though we say it's usher to read on Shabbos by candlelight because you might tilt the candle, right, to make it brighter, there's an exception, which is, what does it say? If there's two people reading together who will remind each other not to light, right, to play with the candle, then you're allowed to read. What does that tell you?
There's a way out.
That if there's a way out, we don't make gzeira. Right, because all things being equal, we'd rather not limit your rights. Right? If there's no reason to, we won't. So if we found a way out, then we won't. Now, number five, and this we...
But isn't the biggest attack against that Lopluk?
So sometimes we say Lopluk, right? He's not saying that there's no exception to this. He's bringing different halachic principles into conversation.
It seems like halachic favors the other side of that.
So, sometimes, for sure, sometimes it goes in the direction of Lopluk and, right, making a general rule. Sometimes, though, it doesn't. Right? What he's pointing out, sometimes, not always, right? Sometimes we...
I was trying to say that you see more Lopluk more often than you see the way out.
That might be true. Right? On this one, you might be right. The first three, I think, is definitely right. This is, I think, the weakest of the five. The fifth one, his example is... and... Hesed Meruba means monetary loss. And as we saw last year, some posts can expand monetary loss beyond monetary loss to
spiritual,
emotional, right? Meaning the principle, the fact that when there is a loss, right, we look for, what do we look for when there's Hesed? What do we look for? Kulot. Right? We look to get out of the problem, right? If the gzera will cause a loss, we try to get out of it. So what does that highlight?
The cost,
right? So if we take his arguments, okay, and I want to summarize what we have, and you can read the rest of the article yourself, right? The real question we wanted to ask today is what? Is, in addition to all the questions we asked in the past, which is, to what extent do laity affect the halakhic process because they poskin with their feet by going to the right, to the poskim that they choose? Or when do they poskin for themselves? Right? Or when do they, right, accept chumras and create new halakhic practices? Right? One of the basic questions you have to ask, really, when you're dealing with the question, what is the role of laity in psak, is, right, the very basic question, which is?
The existence of laity.
Right, the existence of laity, right, the existence of the fact that halakhic isn't made up of poskim and rabbis who are deciding the halakha, but is made up primarily of
people
who are keeping the halakha but not deciding it. What? The people keeping it and not deciding it, right? How does that affect the halachic system? And what I think, right, Rav Shurlo very nicely did in his analysis, right, sort of his meta-analysis of the slippery slope, is that, right, the question of when we set up zero, right? When do we set up slippery slope arguments? When do we forbid things that are fundamentally permitted? Gives us a window into the type of factors, right, that we take into, that the halachic system takes into account, right, in terms of the rights of the lady within the halachic system, right? And he basically divides into, again, into three categories, and he says, what is the number one thing that, right, what's the starting assumption of halacha, right? Now let's reconstruct his argument, right? What?
Oh.
The starting assumption is that, right, we always, right, if we don't know better, what do we assume? That something is usur or mutter?
Mutter,
right? We start with an assumption of rights, right? Not really, right? Really, we start with an assumption of obligations. But we assume that beyond what is known to be obligated, we don't go out of our way to limit rights, right? Within the confines of halacha, we don't go out of our way to make life harder, right? Halacha, it starts with an assumption, we did this before, right? That it's a tarat chayim, right? It should be living, which means, if at all possible, we make it easier, right?
We assume the Torah is restrictive.
What?
We assume the Torah
is restrictive. Torah for sure is at some level restrictive, right? There.
No, I'm just saying we assume it's restrictive.
Like, it is restrictive, right? Okay, we'll take a step back. For assumption number one is there are restrictions.
No, not just that. Restrictive is in that if it's not in Torah, it's in Isser, we assume that therefore the Torah is telling us it's mutter.
Yes. Sure. Right? Yes, we do. Right?
In the Constitution, whether it's restrictive.
Okay. Assumption one is the fundamental category in halacha is obligation, not rights. Two, anything which is not dictated by the halachic system, either as an obligation or as a moral value, right, or halachic value, is mutter, right? The right stems from the fact that there is not, right, an obligation, okay? Starting assumption is, unless we know otherwise, then what?
It's mutter.
It's mutter, right? Now we're talking about when we want to formulate law. We know something is mutter, and the question is, should we make it usser? Right? So what is Rav Shurlo, I think, effectively argued? That what is basically the equation that goes into our heads? Right? Is it worth?
Is it worth the cost, and is the probability make the cost?
The cost on who? Right? Let's be very careful, right? To answer our question.
On the person who doesn't need it.
Is it worth the cost on the people who don't necessarily need it? Meaning, the people who are keeping halacha, right? That's really the issue here. The people who keep halacha, is it worth the cost on their life, right? To what? To protect?
Those people who need it from the problem.
Right. Meaning, is it worth taking away some people's rights to protect halacha from being violated in other circumstances? In order to figure out whether it's worth it, we have to balance three factors. On one side, we have to factor how dangerous it is. And on that side, right, there are two factors. One is
probability and like badness.
Good, thank you. Probability and badness, right? How likely is it that there will be a bad result? And
how bad is the result?
How bad will the result be if it happens? Right? Sikui or sikun in his lasha, right? That has to be balanced against mechir, the cost. How difficult is this going to make life? Right? Halacha doesn't want to make life difficult. So how worth it? So the first thing he notes is, right, what halachic principles push and sort of clarify our vision here. So the first one, Ein goes in gzera al tzibur elam chin yichon rov atzimur lamod ba, which tells you, right, we don't set up gzera unless
the cost isn't too high.
Unless people can handle it, right? So what does that tell us about the halachic system? That it assumes, what does halacha assume? That in order for law to be legitimate, right? In order for, at least rabbinic law, right? In order to establish new laws, right? What has to be true?
It has to be followable.
They have to be followable. Now, let's step out for a moment. Daraisa, right? Biblical law. Is this true, yes or no?
Technically not.
Is it?
Technically not true, but like that doesn't mean that we don't like it doesn't end up being true because
is it true?
Philosophically.
Well, Chazal have a very strong philosophical claim, right? Meaning we're right. Well, yeah, there's a few phrases, right? Meaning
it's philosophically true, but it's not necessarily
right. It's not necessarily true, but the Rabbanan are modeling themselves after a philosophical principle they see latent in Torah. That God doesn't make biblical laws that people can handle. Right? Let's throw out phrases that indicate that. One is, Lo nitna Torah malchei hasharis. Right? Other one is, Lo dibra Torah ela keneged Can I get?
Yetzer hara.
Yetzer hara, right? That we only set up laws if you can handle it. But if we know you can't handle it, then what does Hashem do?
Nah.
He makes it mutter, right? Yifas tor, v'chadam, other one. Ein HaKadosh Baruch Hu ba betrunya in briyosa, right? Hashem is not out to get you. Right? So that notion, right, Chazal see it latent in Daraisas. Now, we don't have the right to change the Daraisas if we see it's not true, but Chazal assumed that just like in rabbinic law, we won't create new law if people can't handle it. They assume that that's true about
biblical law.
All law, right? Biblical law and rabbinic law. Second issue that he brought, Ein Gozer Gzeira L'Gzeira, means that it's not worth limiting people's rights if we're only trying to protect what? Protections, right? We only limit people's rights in the halachic system to protect things which are intrinsically valuable, right? What's the exception to that rule? Dabur chamur, right? Right, or it's the same thing, right? But the more important one, if it's too chamur, meaning under certain circumstances, right? Avodah zara is something which is so bad, it's worth you giving up multiple levels of rights, right? So we balance your rights against Chumra, right? Other examples are Nida. In Nida, we also do this. We're Gozer, Gzera, L'Gzera. Right? Three. Davar Sheino Matzir, L'Gozer, Chachamim. Which means, we're not going to limit your rights if...
The probability is
not. It's not probable that the danger will come into fruition. Four is, again, we want you to have rights, so if at all possible, what do?
Allow
it. Right? We try to find a different way of solving the problem.
We make laws with their built-in loopholes.
Well, sometimes we build laws with the loophole, sometimes we don't set up the law at all, right? And the fifth is have some ruba and the like, that when there's a cost that's too high, right, then we look for ways of, right,
lowering
the cost, right, of creating the problem. Now, right, what he continues to do in the end of this, which is, I think, a helpful exercise, but not for now, is that this is not true in just true in halacha. He's right that if you sort of, you know, take a step back and look from a bird's eye view, these basic principles can act not just to clarify halachic issues, but clarify general ethical issues. Right? Because the same assumptions can be brought to bear. Right? So, this week, all I really wanted to do was I wanted to analyze this, because I think this framework is very helpful. Because until now, what we've been talking about is in the halachic system, right, to what extent, right, can you paskin this, that, you know, but even more fundamental question, right, which I think we've shed some light on today, is to what extent does the existence of people keeping the system affect how the system itself is formulated?
So, halacha is affected by reality.
Yes. I know, it's terrible, Chaim. And next week, what we'll talk about is the question of minhag, right, on actual brera, on actual deciding of halacha, right? Once there's halacha on the ground, we want to figure out what it is, not should we initiate new halacha, right? That's what we're going to deal with next week. Yes.
Couldn't you roll back some of the gezeiros if the generation... Take something like medicines on Shabbos. Nobody's going to grind medicine anymore. Like, originally, it's because if you took medicine or you needed medicine, you'd grind it. A, people don't grind medicine. And B, we're weaker. I mean, a little headache now could affect someone more than maybe 300 years ago when people were stronger. So why don't they roll back something like that?
So the simple reason we don't roll it back is because... Right, and this is what we meant, you know, I sort of skipped over before, is that, right, these limitations only seem to apply in cases where the decree never took effect, right, where no one kept it, right? If people kept it and then later people don't keep it, or it's hard, right, then the only way to uproot it, right, because there's the counter to this whole question is the reality that halacha is formal. Right, and one of the implications of the fact that halacha is formal is that under normal circumstances, right, with the exception of this case where no one kept it to begin with, the only way to uproot a law is with a greater Sanhedrin, which we don't have. Right now, the problem is that we often don't have a predictive rule because some types of gzeiros and Shabbos we assume are contingent on their rule, and sometimes we assume they're not. Medicine, the direction of psak has gone, is to assume that even though the reason doesn't really apply, it does apply. By like music, many posts can think that's not true, right? They allow clapping, even though clapping is quasi-musical because we don't make music on Shabbos. Now, in the specific case of medicine, there's a better answer to the question, which is that it's only usher to take medicine on Shabbos if it isn't that bad. Right, meaning if you're in fact bedridden, then you're allowed to take medicine. right? So built into the gzera itself definitionally is that it's limited to cases where it's not that painful. If it's too painful, right? As I think I was visiting Penn a few years ago for Shabbos, the rabbi was giving a shir on it, and he said the formulation goes like this, which is almost always a good formulation. If you're healthy enough to get up and find the rabbi to ask whether you can take medicine, the answer is probably no. If you're stuck in bed and can't come ask me, the answer is yes, right? So in the medicine case itself, right, there happens to be that built-in price, you know, control of cost. But it's complicated, right? The balance to all of this is the fact that under certain circumstances, obviously halacha is formal, even when, even when there's a seemingly too high of a cost. But that's the sort of the balance to this question. Yeah. Anything else? Or mincha? Yeah. Okay. Tov, shkoyach.